On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf Steve Barry, whose new book is The Kaiser's Web. It's from Minotaur Books, and this is the latest adventure of a pretty interesting fellow who's not exactly a spy, but yet does spy stuff. How would you describe Cotton? Is he a spy, or is he just a guy who does some spy stuff?
He doesn't like to be called a spy. He actually doesn't like those words. He doesn't think it really fits him. He was more the eyes and ears on the ground that could make decisions and do things and make things happen. He considered himself an intelligence officer.
Okay.
And I think most CIA agents would call themselves that, intelligence officers, not spies. Cotton isn't kind of an ordinary guy. I mean, I created him that way. He's just, there's nothing extraordinary about him except that he can rise to the occasion when he needs to do extraordinary things. And so I think that's why people have identified with him and why he's caught on now after 16 novels.
You know, the other day I was going through my late brother-in-law's library to take all the books in it to figure out, you know, which charities to give them to and so forth. I ran across two of your earliest Cotton Malone novels. I never realized that he had read any of your books, and as he tended toward Westerns and stuff. And I was so tickled because I thought, wow, I can go back now and read some of the early adventures, because really I've only had the chance to read the last three books that you've written, including The Kaiser's Web. And so I was kind of thrilled to think, well, I can go back and see what he was like at first. But so Cotton Malone has always been not some super guy, but just a smart guy, a guy with good instincts, a great researcher. But he's fine with having the quiet life that he had for a while, too, as a bookseller.
He is. I never envisioned him to be a Daniel Craig kind of fella.
Yeah.
You know, that image. I did not. That's not the way I looked at him. I looked at him more like a George Clooney kind of figure.
Yeah.
You know, he's a retired Justice Department agent. He lives in Copenhagen. He owns an old bookshop, and he gets himself into trouble all the time. Now, he's retired, but he went out at 47. He went out early. So he's still very young. And Cotton hasn't aged. I quit aging him about 7 or 8 books ago. So in Cotton's world, time has stood still for him. So he stays. He always says he's staring down 50 is what he says. So that's Cotton. And as I said, I didn't give him super abilities, though he has talents and he has courage. He also has faults and fears, and we explore those. The Lost Order. The 14th Colony explored one of Cotton's deepest fears that we dealt with in there. So I've looked at him, you know, I've looked at his personality and how he is, and he's grown a lot. So from those early books, when you go back to the Templar Legacy, the Alexandria Link, the Venetian Betrayal, that's when Cotton was born.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very different guy today than he was then. And readers should know, though, you do not have to read my books in any sequence or any order. I write them where you can pick them up and read them however you please.
That's an important thing. There are those novelists who end up writing a series that if you don't start with the beginning and work your way up, you never really understand the characters.
No, I don't do that. I
like that. The newest situation that Cotton Malone finds himself in is he's been asked by a former U.S. president to help out a friend who is the German chancellor, and she is running for re-election, correct?
Correct.
And she has a very vigorous opponent, and she's concerned about this guy because something just seems a little off kilter about him, and indeed, there's a lot of intrigue. I think the hardest thing about talking to you about this book is you're just going to have to say, okay, we're not going to talk about that.
I have to be careful because I don't want to give anything away. We will say that each candidate, there's a secret regarding each candidate. one candidate knows the other's secret, but the other doesn't know the other's, and that's where the intrigue comes in. And then we find out that the secrets aren't quite what we thought they were. So there's a kind of a double whammy surprise in the novel that should catch the reader off guard. I hope it does anyway. It was designed to keep you off guard. It's an interesting adventure because it deals with something out of World War II, something I stumbled across in research about 4 years ago. And I realized there was a novel there because I said, wow, I didn't know that. Wow, I never had no idea that actually existed and that's real. And so the novel was woven around that. I can't tell you what it is because it'll give away the book, but it's there, and it's real, and it's interesting. And, you know, World War II has been done to death, and that's one reason why I haven't done it. Mm-hmm. But I did come across something kind of fresh, kind of hasn't been done as much, and so we wove this tale around it.
Well, in places that are very old, like Germany, the history never goes completely away. The past is never does not stay the past. When we are thinking about how many generations we are removed from the end of World War II, this gives you a place where you can work. And I'm going to mention something, a historical situation that I read about in another book a couple of years ago, and that was that the Soviet Union had some forensic evidence of the actual disposition of the corpses of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun Hitler, that they somehow got parts of them and kept them and never told the West about it. And I know that to a certain extent that this affects the events in the Kaiser's Web, but this apparently we didn't discover until after the Soviet Union fell apart and certain things came to light that were not previously known.
Yeah, we can actually talk about this a little bit because it doesn't really give away anything in the novel. This is not a novel about Hitler surviving World War II.
Right.
It's not about that. The book very clearly makes it that Hitler died on April 30th, 1945. Now, the Soviets discovered the bodies. We now know that for a fact. They found the bodies. They took the bodies, though, and disposed of them and got rid of them because Stalin wanted the world to think Hitler may have survived because he kept everyone on edge.
Right.
And he could play around. Sun Tzu, the great strategist, said that there is great freedom of movement within chaos as long as you control the chaos.
Mm.
And that's what Stalin was doing.
Right.
Now, they had this skull cap that supposedly was Hitler's skull cap, but we now know it's not. It's actually a female skull cap, and it actually has a bullet wound in it. Eva Braun, there's no evidence that Eva Braun died of a bullet wound. She died of cyanide poisoning. Hitler died of a bullet wound. But the skull cap that they have is not from it's not correct. It doesn't fit. So they really don't have anything there. But we know from Soviet records that it came to light after the fall of the Soviet Union that they did find the bodies, they did dispose of them, and they kept the world off guard with that. And it worked. It actually worked.
Right.
It kept everyone on edge for a long, long time.
You know, this does not surprise me a lot. From everything that I've read about Joseph Stalin, he was a fairly diabolical character. And as lethal as Adolf Hitler was, Stalin...
More so.
He was more so immensely. It was the first time I visited Russia was in 2009. And there was a begrudging admiration for Stalin still among even the younger people in Russia because they said, well, we needed somebody strong like that to rule this vast country. You know, we're so much bigger than you guys are. We need somebody like that. And that's why we like the current leader that they had and still have.
Russians like very strong dominators. They've been dominated for centuries. I mean,
right.
The Tartars dominated them. You know, the czars dominated them. The Soviets dominated. The communists dominated them. They've been totally dominated since, you know, the 13th century.
Right.
So they're very used to and accustomed to that. And Stalin was more lethal than Hitler. He killed far more people than Hitler did.
Oh yeah.
And we'll never even know how many people he killed. And he was a great strategist. He knew how to play the game and he knew how to keep the West off guard and it worked. This book though deals with something a little more interesting about someone else who was in that bunker, Martin Bormann, and whether or not he made it out.
Right.
To this day, we have no clue whether Martin Bormann survived the war or not. We do not know. And it's a fascinating thing what happened to Bormann after the war and what may have occurred and what he put in place to happen before the war ended. That's what this novel is about, and it's all true, too.
I learned a lot about Bormann from your novel. He's one of those guys whose name is mentioned a lot, but you don't really know what were his skill sets. And apparently he was a master at manipulating funds and moving things around and then taking care of things. I've been to Brazil a couple of times, and what amazed me about Brazil is that there were expat colonies of Germans and Japanese and Italians before World War II. But after World War II, of course, they expanded exponentially, and even more so in Argentina. Perón was the guy in charge. So,
made it easy for them.
And so the situations that you lay out in the book with Bormann and others potentially escaping into South America is pretty possible.
Yeah, we know for a fact that a large quantity of Germans migrated to Argentina and southern Chile after World War II. That's an established historical fact. Many war criminals were located in those areas, you know, from the 1950s up until the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
The area that you go down there to Bariloche, which is a lovely town in southern Argentina, the whole place looks like Bavaria. It has the feel of Bavaria. It's very much like you're in Germany. There's a huge German population still there. Those Germans, a lot of them came after World War I, so they were already there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was easy to immigrate there during and after World War II. It is a good thing for us that Martin Bormann was not in charge of Germany. If he had been the supreme commander of Germany, we might have been in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler was a narcissist and a fool and you know, kind of wouldn't listen to anybody and thought
right.
He knew everything. Bormann was just the opposite. He was clever. He was devious. He was treacherous. He would have been far more difficult to take down than Hitler was.
Yeah. We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Steve Barry, who is the author of The Kaiser's Web, the newest Cotton Malone adventure. It's from Minotaur Books. And this time we have Cotton starting out in Germany and traveling to a lot of places. And the reason that he travels to those places and what he finds in those places is what makes this such a terrific novel with all the twists and turns. I do like the fact that when I read your novels, for one thing, even though they're about adult situations, there's no obscenities, which is sadly present far too many novels. You have smart people, and they talk smart, and they don't necessarily need to use a lot of profanity, and that's refreshing.
I don't have any in the books at all. The only book, I did The Amber Room, my very first novel. There's a lot of that in there. There's one character that has a trash mouth, and he just says anything and everything. And I realized after that I really didn't have to do that, so I never did it again. And
yeah.
You know, you may get an occasional damn or hell in my books, but that's about it.
Yeah.
And very occasionally, maybe once in a novel, if that much. I just found that I don't need that language, and so I just leave it out. You know, sometimes gosh darn just doesn't work.
Right.
You know, it just doesn't work. So you have to come up with a way to make it, you know, believable and
mm-hmm.
fit. But I try to keep it down. I don't have any sex in the novels either. The Amber Room is the only one that ever had sex in it. So those two things do not appear in the books.
Cotton Mather has a great love interest in this book, and she is smart. And she is savvy, but you're right. There's no bodice ripping scenes or anything like that.
No,
it's really nice. I think that's a real strength.
I've just found I didn't need it. It wasn't necessary, and so I just didn't do it, and I just left it out. Now the Amber Room's a different story. It's a whole different ballgame. There's everything and everything's and anything's in there. And I will say it was fun to write that character because he could just say anything come out
right.
of his mouth, and it was a lot of fun to do it, but I realized very quickly after that I didn't want to do it again.
Yeah. Obviously, you're doing something right. You have 25 million books in print, translated into 40 languages, and you and your wife are the founders of History Matters, which is dedicated to historical preservation. I think that's very cool. Steve serves as an emeritus member of the Smithsonian Libraries Advisory Board. When you do a novel like this one, where do you do most of your research? Do you go to the places?
I do.
Cool.
I do. Now, and I did not, in this book, I did not go to South Africa or South America. I was not able to make those trips, and I wanted them included in a Cotton Malone adventure, so I went ahead and put them in there, and I talked to people who had been there, so I learned from them on that. But by and large, I go to the places. I do most of my research at a gigantic used bookshop up in Jacksonville, Florida, called the Chamblin Book Mine.
I know
it. It's a lovely place. It's
yes.
Got thousands and thousands of books in it.
The novel before this one, the Cotton Malone novel before this one, was set in Poland, and it came out just after I had spent 2 weeks in Poland, which we talked about the last time that we talked. I really enjoyed your description and also your explaining how to pronounce Polish words, which I wish had come out before I went there, because I'm afraid I massacred the language pretty well.
Yeah, they're tough. Those are really tough. It's one of the hardest languages for me to get the sounds of the vowels and the consonants. Poland was one place I did go. I'd been there like 3 or 4 times, so I did a lot of on-site research there. It's one of my favorite places in the world.
Yeah,
95% of the time I go to the places. There's just a few that I've not been. I did not go to Antarctica, which I would love to go to Antarctica, but just haven't been able to do that. You know, just sometimes it's not possible. You don't have to go to a place to write about it, but it does help.
Yeah, you get a real feel for the place. And of course, 2020, most everybody stayed at home. We didn't get much of an option. Yeah.
Me included. Yeah, I didn't go anywhere, and I won't go anywhere in 21 either. So I don't go back on the road again until next year.
Okay. I understand. We have to be wise, don't we?
Yes. Certainly do. I'm not a spring chicken anymore, so I can't run around and do whatever I want. And so we won't get back on an airplane again until about mid-2022.
When you were working on the setup for this, obviously you take a bit of reality and then figure, what if? Did you have sort of a particular interest in Germany, or this just made it easy to come into this very complicated situation of the Nazi money that got smuggled out of the country as the war was winding down to its inevitable close and so forth?
It was a good place to start, yeah, but I wanted it, my novels are set in the present day,
right.
So I wanted it to revolve around the German elections for the next Chancellor of Germany, and the way they elect their national leader is very different than the way we elect our national leader, so the reader's going to get an appreciation of how another country does it, how
yes.
their process works, and it is very different than ours. And there is a strong nationalistic movement sweeping across Europe right now, and it's very prevalent in many countries, and it's becoming a little bit alarming. The strength of the movement is picking up, and I wanted to explore that as well, so the readers could get an appreciation of what's going on over there. It's we had some nationalistic. Over the last 4 years, we've had a lot of nationalistic thought processes here, but nothing like they've got going over there.
Right,
Is
part of that because of the refugee situation? There's so many refugees from the Middle East that have
it's
flooded
the
into
human
Europe.
Migration in history, almost
right.
Millions of people moving from one place to another, and it is changing the culture of Europe. It's changing the face of Europe. And they're not real good with change.
The change
is not something that they're really good and comfortable with. And so it is fueling up things, and it's very prevalent, and this novel deals with it.
Europe is interesting. So many people came from Europe to what is America, and that we think that we really understand how European people think and work. Visiting there disavows you of that misconception, because they do things very differently, and and we confuse the crap out of them too. They can't understand why we have people running for an office for 2 years when they have people running for office for like 6 weeks.
Yes, it's a whole different process. The way they're funded is different. The way the advertising done is different. Everything about it is different. Now, a little bit of our way is seeping in over there. But by and large, they have a totally different way of doing things. And I think the readers will get an appreciation and go like, wow, that is quite unique and very different than the way we do things here. And the system has its flaws. It has an ability to be manipulated, and that's what you'll see in the novel, as one of the candidates does just that.
I think, too, we in America don't realize how large we are compared to Europe, say. I had a man that worked for me at the radio station who was an exchange student, a tennis player, about 20 years ago, and he was very, very, very interesting guy to talk to. Mucha Marapa is his name, and he would talk to us at the station about the difference between the United States and Europe. Now, he was his parents were from Africa, but he was a British citizen. So he said, there's no such thing as an African British person. We're just British. That's all there is to it. He said, so that's one thing that's different. He said, so you have race here in America, but we have class in Britain. That is to say, that's what we argue about. That's what divides us is class.
Sure.
Yeah, he said, you have no idea of how big America is. He said, when you ask somebody here, you know, how far something is away, you go, oh, well, it's a 3 hours drive. And he said, we would never think of that. He said, because from one end of England to the top of Scotland is probably only a 6 hour drive. And that's about like the state of Alabama.
Very small, very tight, very compact place. Been around a long time. Mm-hmm. Each country has its own history, its own culture, its own thought processes. Everything about each country is very different than the other country. They're jammed up together. They're trying to get along. It's hard as hell to get along. Europe is very different than here. You know, we have a First Amendment. You know, they don't have that over there. You
right.
know, there is no freedom of expression over there. You know, it's different over there, and it's different here. We deal very much from a standpoint of we are geared from birth almost to distrust government.
Right.
That's how our government works. We distrust it. And that's how it functions, because of our distrust of the government and our skepticism of the government. Where over there it's just the opposite.
Right.
They are bred to trust the government, to depend on the government for everything, that the government will take care of us. Where here it's just the opposite of that. So we're very different folks, very different people in many ways.
Well, I think that's another thing that makes reading a book like The Kaiser's Web interesting is that, like you have said, you build into it an explanation of what it's like to be in another country and what their laws are like, what their elections are like, what their culture is like, the difficulties they face in an ever-expanding world. For a while there, it looked like Germany was going to end up conquering Europe by just paying off everybody's debts. Their economy was so strong, they were... back when the euro was in great danger a couple of years ago, the countries were defaulting on all their loans. Germany was stepping in to say, well, I'll take care of Greece's debt. Here you go. And I'm thinking, yeah, if they'd done it that way 80 years ago, they'd all be speaking German.
Yeah, this is over. They can't do that now. I mean, the European economy has been stagnated for quite some time now, and things have really stagnated and locked down over there. And mm-hmm. so they're, you know, the pandemic has made things even, you know, more difficult. So Europe is got some reckoning to deal with, and I'm going to explore that some in some future novels.
Ah, very good. I'm not going to ask you to say which is your favorite novel, because I've been told that that's like asking what's your favorite child, and no matter how you answer, it's never going to be a good thing.
No, I love all my children equally.
There you go.
I love all my books equally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it the one when you finished a novel? Are you already thinking about this is where I want my character to go next time?
Yeah, I would have been thought about that for 6 months, actually.
Okay.
When I finish a novel, I start the next novel the next day, because I've already done 6 months of my preliminary research. I'm ready to go. So, you know, because I need 12 months to write a book, and so I finish and turn it in. I got to turn the next one in 12 months later, so I got to get going. So I've already done the preliminary research, and I'm ready to go at that point. And I know pretty much where I want to go for the first half of the book, you know, and then as I write the first half, I figure out the last half.
I think that is an interesting thing to learn, too, because most of us think of linear that, okay, you write the book, you turn it in, they go, yeah, yeah, print, print, print. You do the interviews, and you've got a couple of months to kind of enjoy the publicity.
No,
but that's not the way
not the way it works at all.
Yeah,
no, in fact, what happens is I wrote this book. I turned this book in January of 2020. I wrote it in 2019. So it's been 2 years since I've dealt with this novel. I literally have to get the book out and reread it before we do the interviews.
Right.
Because I forgot. I've already written another book between then, and I'm working on the next book. So So this book is completely out of my brain right now. And so I have to, I literally get the book out and I thumb through it page by page and I get stuff back in my head again. And it's fascinating when you do that because I go, oh, wow, I forgot. I forgot I put that in there. Oh, yeah, yeah. And because you literally do purge it out of your brain because there's no way I can keep every detail of 20 novels in my brain.
Sure, sure.
It's not possible.
That explains when I've interviewed people before that were novelists, and I say, well, you know, in chapter such and such, and they go, do you have your book close by? I said, yeah, look it up.
And
I thought, gosh, I thought they'd remember that. But now I see what you're saying. Yeah, you can't afford to live with the one book for 2 years. You can't
you can't
make a living that way.
Because I've already written, see, I turned that in 20. I've already written the novel for 2022, and it's already, you know, so it's done. And I'm writing 20, you know, so I'm 2 years ahead of you.
And that of course makes perfect sense. But that's what makes it interesting, I think, for us to get a chance to talk and for our listeners to go, oh, that's how it works. That's very cool.
I get caught sometimes because they'll ask me a question about a character and I do not remember. and I go like, gosh, almighty, I got to remember that character. It's hard because it's terrible, but you know, I've written the book and I'm done with it and I've moved on.
Sure.
And now it's time for the readers to enjoy it. But I try to get up to date. And this one, I went back through it a couple of weeks ago and I got ready for everything.
Well, Steve, it's a great pleasure to get a chance to talk to you again. I really love the character of Cotton Malone, and I enjoy the novel so much. I'm looking forward to the one you already wrote and the one that you're going to write before we get a chance to talk again.
Well, we'll come back on and talk about it. In the meantime, you know, they can find out all about me and the novels at my website, you know, steveberry.org. They can check it out there.
Excellent. Steve, thank you so much for joining us
again
on the Bookshelf, my friend. And our thanks once again to Steve Berry, the New York Times and number one internationally best-selling and award-winning author of The Warsaw Protocol, which is the last one we talked about, The Malta Exchange, The Bishop's Pawn, The Lost Order, The 14th Colony, The Patriot Threat, The Lincoln Myth, The King's Deception, The Columbus Affair, The Jefferson Key, The Emperor's Tomb, The Paris Vendetta, The Charlemagne Pursuit, Venetian Betrayal, The Alexandria Link, The Templar Legacy, The Third Secret, The Romanov Prophecy, and The Amber Room, which was his first. His newest book, The Kaiser's Web. By the way, Steve Berry was a trial lawyer in Georgia for 30 years and held elective office for 14 of those. And once again, he and his wife co-founded History Matters, a nonprofit organization raising money for the preservation and conservation of historic sites. And they have raised almost $1 million for organizations such as the James Thurber House, the Edgar Allan Poe House in Baltimore, and the historic Kansas City Foundation. He is also a founding member and former president of International Thriller Writers. Kaiser's Web, available from Minotaur Books. Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf, and be sure to check out my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening in, and God bless.